This week on the show, we cover OpenBSD's 7.7 release and all the cool features that are in there. We also look at the ZFS orchestration tools, part two, about replication, you know, pushing and pulling and all these things. Switching customers from Linux to BSD because boring is good, which revisits the blog post that Stefano Marinelli did from EuroBSDCon 2024 Dublin. Graphed and measured, running TCP input in parallels, all good things coming to OpenBSD, as well as the next one, introducing an OpenBSD LLDP daemon. Hardware discovery, ACPI, and device trees is what Mr. Giulio Marino is telling us. Yeah, I remember this one. And then we have the 2025 FreeBSD community announcement here for you. If you get this in time, then you can participate in the FreeBSD community survey and provide feedback about your experience with FreeBSD. There's more in this episode, as always, so check it out now. This is BSD Now, episode 610, OpenBSD 7.7. This episode of BSD Now is brought to you by Tarsnap. Go to tarsnap.com/BSDNow to find online backup for truly paranoid people. And if you want to support this show in one way or the other, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/BSDNow. And we thank you in advance for that. Hi, this is the recording date of the 29th of April 2029, and we are your hosts, Benedict Heuschling.
And I'm Jason Tubner.
Hello, hello.
Hey, Benedict, guess what? We just had 22 minutes of pre-show.
Yeah.
Lord. Yes, we had a pretty big discussion in the pre-show. So, you know, this is just a dead set plug to join our Patreon. And then you can, too, get the whole show unedited.
Everything we talk about.
I'm not going to talk about what we talked about. That's one for the subscribers. They can go and listen to that now. But we've moved into the show now.
And it is for everyone. Yeah.
This is the show for everyone now. So first up is a big hurrah and congratulations to the OpenBSD project.
Timely release, 40
hours
always.
Ago. As of recording right now, we saw the release of 7.7. People think that that's a versioning number. Really, it's, you know, OpenBSD 77 is probably the easiest way to say that, which was released on the 28th of April 2025, which is the 58th release. And Theo sent out the email yesterday morning. It was 4 a.m. local my time when he sent that out. I sort of got a whiff that it was coming very, very soon. I put a post out on Mastodon about that on Sunday when my mirror finished filling up.
You're early, up. Yeah.
In this. Yeah. So when you see that, when you see your own mirror sort of, you know, go boop and finish its sync, well, it had. So the mirror that I run only hosts the AMD 64, ARM 64, and RISC V parts of OpenBSD releases. So
it's a
smaller
ones.
Subset, but that's because they're the modern architectures that generally everybody uses. There's, you know, if you need the niche ones like HPPA or Luna 88K or any of those sorts of things, or i386. Yeah. That's, you know, the upstream mirrors for that sort of stuff. I just host the stuff that's more popular architectures, especially here in Australia. But anyway, back to the release. The release is very exciting because I call this release the big unlock. So the main improvement is in this one, and the big headline act is the SMP improvements. So there was a significant amount of work to unlock the TCP stack. So previously, the UDP stack, and we've reported about that in previous episodes, but the TCP stack has been unlocked, and further performance should be now realized for everybody that uses OpenBSD, especially on the network level. There was some other funky stuff done that are not really in the release notes, but there's been sort of talk in the mail list about it. But what we're focusing on here today is the release notes and what's happened. So the SNP improvements, there's a heap of sysctl improvements. I won't go into each one of them, but they start kern timeout stats, kern allow kmem, kern.video.record, net.inet.gre allow, and so on and so forth. There's reduced kernel lock contention when tearing down file back regions, unlock PT signal, P signal, and PR signal by using the PSMTX mutex. Use the mutex to make PSP4MP safe. Lock send socket buffer for fstat syscall. Made lock changes to reduce lock contention. Made the video fill tops MP safe. Run TCP output and TCP timers in parallel. TCP send and receive system calls use shared netlock. Multiple user LAN threads can work on different sockets in parallel. TCP output no longer blocks IP processing. And TCP timer also uses locks that are specific to the socket that they're working on. Other network traffic can be processed by different CPUs. Socket splicing is MP safe for TCP. Some of the sysctl syscalls affecting TCP no longer block network operations on other CPUs. Only TCP input still uses exclusive netlock and prevents other parts of the network stack from running in parallel. There's further context in the release notes around the SNP improvements, but it's a huge list. There's a fair bit of work that's been done in the kernel, and it's amazing what the team has done in the last 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
There's been a fair bit of, you might remember, there was a fair bit of pre-work that's had to go on to get to this state. And, this has improved things like virtual interfaces like VIO. The performance of that will be, a game changer for people that use it in a virtualization space, especially on Linux KVM. That's where we see VIO in OpenBSD used a fair bit. And that performance will, be a big game changer for a lot of people.
So something that caught my eye is one I haven't seen before is Btrace, which is basically the bug tracer, and it's probably similar to Dtrace on OpenBSD, or that's OpenBSD's version of Dtrace. So that was new to me.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff that's actually jumped out. It's like the release was done without fanfare. And I think it deserves a lot more. Back in the day, there used to be a theme that went around the release. And I would have put a theme on this, and I would have made it a big unlock, like, let Puffy out of jail or something that, or unshackle Puffy.
Yeah, because just release the beast if it's a beast.
Yeah, release the beast. And, I really put this up there for one of the best releases that has come out. I did all my upgrades, like, as it came out, basically fault-free. There was a few things with the packages when they're upgraded, but you just run it again and it's cleaned up.
And it feels faster?
Yeah, it feels snappier, especially the ones that I've got out on. We have small companies here in Australia that run public cloud. And the two instances that I have, one's my mail server, and another one is actually used for the BSD Now redirector. So where if somebody types in bsdnow.tv, that's not where our podcast sits on Fireside. Our podcast sits on Fireside, but that's under www.bsdnow.tv. But we still need a redirector that does a 301 redirect to send people to that location. And there's a fair bit of traffic that happens on that particular,
which is good. I mean,
yeah, well, popular. it's good that people hit that root domain. Gives a bit of gives us a bit of analytics into what's going on. We do see a fair bit of AI hit that as well. We eat our own dog food, and if we need to redirect you to our podcast site, we will use a BSD machine to do that. So, that also got upgraded. So it was fault-free. Great. Just worked.
Mm-hmm.
there is other stuff here I'm going to touch on. So for platform-specific improvements, we saw ARM64 get some improvements. Set AP power state, fixing the SMC initialization on the M1 MacBook with the latest system firmware. Implemented a new PMAP populate interface on the ARM64 and RISC-V64 to help PMAP enter succeed when there's enough free physical memory, but we can't allocate KVA to map that memory. Optimize PMAP teardown by skipping TLB flushes, giving a 5% performance boost for kernel builds. Enabled PAC on hardware that uses the new QARMA3 cipher. And implement support for SVE, which is the scalable vector extension. AMD did see some improvements as well. Added the ability for bus DMMM alloc to recognize the bus DMA 64-bit flag and allocate memory for DMA without any 4 GB restrictions on AMD 64. Allowed bootloader to run as AMD SEV guest on QEMU with EFI. Allowed kernel boot on QEMU with AMD SEV. Allow the use of MSI with QEMU default PCI i440FX machine. Stop the AMD 64 leak of kernel stack guard pages. And implemented the AMD SEV PSP download firmware command to load new firmware onto the chip. Made the AMD SEV automatically load PSP firmware during the VMD startup. There was various kernel improvements, the improved responsiveness in OOM situations, out-of-memory situations, and made free target checks coherent, removed the ability for specific root and dump or swap devices on ST. This was actually a good one. It actually came up in conversation a couple of days ago around who is using ST to boot their systems. So if you are an OpenBSD user out there, or any BSD user for that matter, and you are loading your system from tape, we'd love to hear from you. I'm sure you've got a war story or two to tell us, and we'd like to know why you are using tape to boot your system or bootstrap your system. So please send your feedback into feedback@bsdnow.tv and let us know that you use tape to boot your systems. There was other things here in the various kernel improvements. There was some improvements in VMM and VMD. I know there's a lot of people that do use the virtualization component of OpenBSD, and there is also OpenBSD Amsterdam, which builds their whole product offering
on shout out to
OpenBSD's VMMD stuff. So some added improvements there. There was some user land features, not that much, but there is some features there, various bug fixes and tweaks, but you know, the bugs are getting less and less each time I see a release, which is good to see. It means that everybody's keeping on it and quashing those bugs before it hits the release. So, you know, dogfooding your operating system through current right up to release means that you quash a lot of bugs before they see the light of day. Yeah. There's improved hardware support and drive fixes. So many here, especially around UVideo. So check out the release notes for those. There is some improved network hardware support, and these will be applicable to anybody that's using newer hardware. As I talked about with the VIO, it is in here. So let's just go through some of these. Added ICE, a driver for the Intel E810 Ethernet, which supports 1, 10, 25, 50, and 100 gigabit devices. Increased the receive MBUF size with LRO in VIO 4, helping TCP splice performance. So this is where you'll start to see a pickup on your virtual machines. Fix the XBF and XNF not attaching on XCPNG and Xen. So again, another virtualization environment. Added printing for a number of queues and interrupt and Ethernet address details in MCX. Fix the BNXT receive refill timeout to only receive rings that are currently empty, preventing possible corruption and crashes. added support for AX88772D to AXEN, added IXV, a driver for virtual functions of the Intel 82598EB, 82559, and X540, enabled RxTX checksum offloading on the IAVF, added RSS multi-queue support for AQC 11X models, added support for reading EEPROM pages from AQ, and started clearing the OACD flag on transmit queues when IXL is reset. There's some wireless drivers and some boot improvements as well, especially around the FW update. And the other areas, there's a heap of work done in the ports tree, obviously. TMUX's got a heap of improvements as well. LibreSSL saw a version bump up to 4.1.0. As to the OpenSSH finally get to 10.0. So there was a security fix, just one security fix there. There was a big list of potentially incompatible changes. So if you are using SSHD on remote systems, I would suggest making sure you clearly and concisely go over this part of the release notes to make sure that you don't get locked out of your system after an update.
Yeah.
It does talk in other areas when we have talked in previous shows about some work that's been happening in SSH. So, you know, where we've talked about splitting the binary, the SSH binary up into multiple things like SSHD and SSHD session. There's more work pending in that area. So just be mindful that that is taking place by the SSH maintenance crew. Lots of packages as always. Your usual Zenokara, LLVM, and GCC updates and patches are listed on the release page. So if you haven't already, please do set some time aside and get your OpenBSD boxes up to date with the latest release. And you've got any specific things that you really appreciate about the new release, let us know. And we'll you know, get your feedback on the show. We'd love to hear about how people use the BSD operating systems and what they look forward to and what they get out of releases as they come about.
And if you like the release, consider a donation to the OpenBSD Foundation, because that is what makes the project sustainable and ensures that there's future releases like that, and that can benefit everyone, because many of these sub-projects like OpenSSH are used not just in OpenBSD. So there's no better reason to, you know, support the secure internet.
Yeah, there's so many parts of OpenBSD that are portable, and they either get into the other BSDs or other operating systems that are used out there. And there's little to no visibility of that, but some of these other companies that do use the software, because it's liberally licensed, they can do what they choose to do with it. But they are multi-billion dollar companies that in some ways do contribute back, but not as much as they really should for the amount of footprint that they have out there. So yeah, as an individual user, we can support these projects as well by, you know, contributing just a little bit each month. It gives the project certainty to be able to put on hackathons and things like that, to be able to get developers in the one room to get maximum bandwidth and solve problems. It's really good to see these guys in action.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump over to the Clara article of this week. And this is the second part. Remember last time I recorded with Tom, I mentioned the first part, which is ZFS orchestration tools. And this second part is about replication. And Oliver Kittle is the author again. So ZFS replication ensures efficient backups and failover readiness by leveraging snapshots and optimized data transfers. This guide covers push and pull replication and what's the difference between the two, transfer steps, connection methods, compression strategies, and advanced features to help you choose the right tool for your needs. So this begins with, in the first part of this article, we introduced a range of available tools, and you can always listen to the first part on our previous episode, and also the article is linked from this one. So where the focus on that article was on snapshots, and this article will primarily consider replication. And of course, you need snapshots for replication, so that's why they are in this order. Efficient ZFS replication with snapshots. Automating ZFS data replication is useful wherever the same data sets are regularly transferred to the same target locations. This is common for backups and for maintaining secondary servers ready for failover. Using ZFS to send and receive manually is not as simple as SCP or rsync, so some of the tools also provide a simple interface for one-off transfers. However, the performance and efficiency improvements of the ZFS replication feature make it worth the additional setup. While automatic snapshots are our focus in the previous article, snapshots are critical to ZFS replication because they are the atomic unit of change that ZFS send uses to track the current state and the difference in the version of the data on the remote system. The technology behind ZFS snapshots allow for efficient transfers of only incremental changes. And unlike rsync, ZFS doesn't have to compare the blocks on both sides to know what has changed. Using the snapshots, it can easily generate a list of every changed block between a pair of snapshots using only the birth times of the blocks in question. So first, they talk about push versus pull and choosing the right ZFS replication strategy. One of the most powerful aspects of ZFS replication is that it allows the Unix tradition of combining tools that do one thing well with Unix pipes. It is common to use SSH to handle data transfers and orchestrate the remote commands, but you can simply run both ZFS send and ZFS receive locally. This can be useful for backing up data to removable media. And so there are several factors that go into deciding if a system should push changes to the backup or secondary server, or if that server should pull the changes over. One consideration is the failure scenario. If the primary is down and the secondary switches out of read-only mode and accepts new changes, it is easier to disable a pull on the secondary, then resync the primary when it is back up. However, if the primary is pushing, as soon as it comes back up, it will try to push changes to the secondary and either fail, which is the default, or override the divergence of the secondary, which is the force method. And sometimes you don't want this. Security implications. So on the flip side, it's better security practice to design your permissions model such that each server is able to push to the backup rather than the backup machine having privileged access to every machine on your network. In the event of a backup server being compromised, it is possible, or it shouldn't be possible, to use it as a stepping stone to take over every other server in your infrastructure. So consider that. Then choosing the right approach for your setup. When backing up data to a remote system, pushing the data may seem to be the most natural choices. However, having the backup system invoke the entire process, pulling the data may be easier to orchestrate. This tends to cope better with a situation where the backup system is down because the primary system won't be repeatedly failing on contacting. When the backup server comes back online, it can catch up with all the missing changes on its own pace rather than having every remote machine trying to push changes all at once. Then there is ZFS replication transfer steps with Syncoid. We covered Syncoid in the past, and it's a reliable tool and widely used for replication. So let's start by considering a simple manual transfer without any configuration. Synoid comes with a separate Syncoid tools for replication, and a simple command to push a copy of the local system's home directory to a remote server would be as follows. So Syncoid minus R, in this case, zroot /user/home, and then root at server.example.com to tank/backup/home. The only option we're using is lowercase r to recursively transfer the child datasets. If this is helpful, then Syncoid hides much of the underlying complexity, but will now break this down into steps so we can have a fuller understanding and introduce points for further discussion. So first, it opens an SSH connection to the remote system. Syncoid uses an initial SSH connection in master mode, which it later reduces so that you can only need to authenticate once. Second, checks for the existence of the source and target datasets along with the availability of commands and enables ZFS pool features on both local and remote systems. Third is gets the value of the Syncoid:sync ZFS property of the source dataset. This property can be manually set on datasets to limit which hosts it will send the datasets to. And the fourth is check for existing snapshots on the source dataset. On the first run of this simple example, it found none. It also checks for resume tokens and can handle resumption of interrupted partial sends. There's a couple more steps up to 11, but you get the idea for this whole process. Optimizing incremental replication for faster transfer. There's a couple of options, like having the incremental send with the capital I option to update the remote system. So that only sends the differences that are in the replication. So between host and receiving side. Choosing a connection method for ZFS replication, as it's common to already have SSH available and configured, is a good default choice. It provides encryption, which is important anywhere the network is not private. However, it or if performance is a concern, then there are better options. So you can make a direct TCP connection by using Netcat and SOCAT, which are well known and likely that you would expect use. However, mBuffer is a common choice because it handles both network connections and buffering. And there is a couple more utilities around ZFS, like SnapZend with two S's, so SNAPSEND, and ZRAPL, which has a long-running server process, so it's able to listen on a TCP socket directly. There's a couple more info points about compression for replication, snapshot management in ZFS replication, and methods, as well as best practices for configuration. But we leave that to you. It's a long article, but definitely good content. And it closes with finding the right fit for your ZFS backup strategy. There's no shortage of tools for handling both periodic snapshots and replication with ZFS. In terms of functionality, they have a lot of commonalities. So we found that all the tools are somewhat clumsy when dealing with backups through remote. Removable USB disks, more could be done to provide tooling around detecting which disks are currently attached. And often tools are let down by the paucity of their documentation. But that isn't a criticism I could make here. Other than the lack of man pages, several tools are well documented. The choice of tool primarily comes down to personal taste on factors like how they are configured or on trade-off between a simple and understandable tool versus a more complex and featureful tool. ZRAPL is perhaps the most powerful of the tools, while Xanoid does a good job of being capable while still feeling simple and approachable. And lastly, I like the convenient use of ZFS properties for configuration of Zap and SnapZend.
No, good article. I always like these ZFS articles. The only thing that I would probably give my feedback on, not saying there's anything wrong with this article and everybody's designs are different, but over my years, is that ZFS is better to do a pull rather than a push. Mm-hmm. And they did cover that in the article there, where you can't be guaranteed that your backup server is always running. And then there's also the case of your backup server, from a security perspective, should always be untouchable from the production network. So that's where you would have your backup server behind a firewall. So then that way, even the production servers can't touch a backup server, but your backup server can touch a production server. Go in, grab your snapshots, and pull them back. And that's the safest way to conduct your backups. And that way, if your production environment gets hosed, your backup environment's all there, and the production environment can be recreated from that backup environment. So that's just my take on that particular one, to just emphasize on which way your data should go, push or pull. There might be reasons why, like to say, if I just want to send something to my laptop before I take it home or whatever, I might just do a push, and that's fine. But again, you've got to measure what you want as your security profile and what you deem that data is and the protections you need to put around your data.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, good points.
First up in the news roundup tonight is our friend from EuroBSDCon, Liam Robin. So Benedict and myself got to meet Liam. I think we've talked endlessly about catching up with him on the Friday night over dinner after our presentation that we did. Well, it wasn't presentation, it was more tutorial.
It was a tutorial. But we presented also.
Yeah. So Liam has just written another article over on the Register, and it starts off before I get into the article. Actually, when I saw this headline come up in the show notes, I've just gone, oh, we've got Stefano. God, I get it wrong all the time.
It's close.
Sorry, Steph. I thought it was another one of his blog posts, but no, it's not. But it is referring to him. So it's just like, it's just a big roundabout world that we're in. So that goes a bit like this. Switching customers from Linux to BSD because boring is good. Stability, predictability, reliability. Where's the fun in that? And EuroBSD Con 2024, one of Stefanos Marinelli's NetBSD boxes sat quietly serving for a decade because everyone forgot about it. This is how Unix is meant to be. After this year's Open Source Summit in Vienna, the Reg Foss desk traveled to Dublin for the 2024 EuroBSD Con. One of the talks at the event was from the man who built that NetBSD server, talking about switching from Linux to BSD. You can watch his talk on the YouTube recording, and the slide deck is on the event website too, and there's links in his article from that. Back to the article. He talked about the difficulties selling his services when what he offers is reliability and the lack of need for much ongoing support. Now Marinelli has turned his talk into a blog post. Marinelli attained brief fame in the geekier parts of the web a year ago because of a long-forgotten NetBSD server of his, which, with no maintenance of any kind, quietly sat there doing its job until it passed 9 years of uptime. But that's exactly what you want in a server: placid, unexciting reliability. Even on a home gamer level box, something you can throw together in under 48 hours, which then lasts a decade. As his talk conveys rather well, this kind of boring predictability is exactly what is required of an enterprise OS. Long-term, slow-moving, no surprises software that a tiny handful of enterprise Linux vendors work very hard to deliver is the BSD baseline. That means it rarely hits the headlines. And in turn, that kind of community means that its events are different affairs to the big brash industry showcases, such as the event that until a few years ago was still called LinuxCon. The BSD world is smaller and quieter than the Linux world. That's a good thing. Although the BSDs are slightly younger than Linux, NetBSD was first released in April 1993, and FreeBSD followed a couple of months later. They are doing just fine. It also shows that there's an entirely different approach to open source software licensing, which avoids loud public spats, such as those around Elastic and CentOS and Red Hat Enterprise Linux and HashiCorp and Redis. All these companies either changed their licensing or started more closely following the letter rather than the spirit of the licenses, such as the GPL, to prevent commercial competitors profiting from stuff that they're giving away for free. The BSDs take a radical different approach. Their licenses, such as the classic three cores version, allows companies to take their freely available source code and use it to build proprietary products and sell them commercially. If you listened only to vendors like those in the previous paragraph, you'd think this was suicidally self-destructive, and yet the BSD family has been flourishing since OneBSD in 1977, shortly before Linus Torvalds' 8th birthday. We found that some of the themes of Marinelli's talk were echoed by other attendees at the event. The Linux world is full of startups and entrepreneurs and exciting new tech, while the BSD's world mostly isn't. What tends to make Linux folk consider BSD dull is its appeal for developers and users. Marinelli spoke to the difficulty of selling solutions that work but are unfashionable. As he put it, clients are often influenced by hype. A few years ago, it was Linux is a toy. Now it is, why Beehive and not Proxmox? They ask. How can they sell FreeBSD? There's no AI, there's no cloud, there's no Kubernetes, there's no blockchain, there's nothing. We could relate to some of the issues that he described, although not all of them. He talked about losing data on a BTRFS volume, which, from this Vulture's own direct personal experience with BTRFS, is entirely believable. He talked about updating the Linux kernel and rebooting, only to find that the network interface names have changed from dev ENX3E330C9E14E, suddenly became dev ENP10S0F0NP0, making the host inaccessible. One of his overall points is that easy deployment isn't as important as easy long-term maintenance and support. Quote, but the simplest solutions are the easiest to maintain and manage over time. My experience has taught me that my setting something up is often the easiest part. The hardest part is returning to it after 1, 5, or 10 years. Keeping it running, updating it, stabilizing it. Many IT isn't their business, but a tool to achieve their goals. A Kubernetes cluster is fantastic, but it requires maintenance or it's external, so it's no longer ours. We've lost control of the data. Like many people in the FOSS world, Marinelli started out on Linux, but after a few years got interested in the BSD family instead. FreeBSD enthusiast and advocate Florian Azim has recently blogged about making FreeBSD more attractive to new users, and the foundation is working on it. At the same event, we met one of the developers working on modernizing FreeBSD's laptop support, and we recently reported now, aided by the STF funding. If this kind of predictable reliability sounds appealing, you don't need to wait for those changes to happen. For better experience, we suggest treating FreeBSD today much like Windows NT was in the 20th century. That is, before Windows 2000, and therefore before the niceties like plug and play, power management, etc. Use a desktop, not a laptop. Use a wired Ethernet connection, not a wireless link. Don't expect great power management. Check the hardware compatibility list and adapt the hardware to the OS, not the other way around. Don't expect support for the latest CPUs, GPUs, for asymmetric CPU cores, and so on. And don't try and dual boot. To avoid pain, devote a whole drive, or preferably a whole server, to this OS. But saying that, interoperability between Linux and BSD is excellent. They're all forms of Unix. They all talk the same protocols and language. Yet that doesn't mean that all the same programs and command lines are there. They are not. FreeBSD is not a some odd different cousin of Linux. It's very different OS. And its users have different expectations, which in some places do not overlap with those even a knowledgeable Linux user. We picked up some useful info about the problems we had last time with version 13.1, and FreeBSD 14.2 is scheduled for December 2024, shortly before the end of life of 13.3. We plan to take a fresher look at it then.
All right. So yeah, good article, and we, I at least look forward to meet the author again. Both of them. So one of the author of this article and the original presenter, Stefano. And we stay a little bit with OpenBSD themed episode this time. So we have, in addition to the all lockless or more locks released theme of the 7.7 release, this one is about graphed and measured running TCP input in parallel on Undeadly.org. And it's, of course, from the measured packets department. Over on tech, Alexander Bloom is airing a patch to improve parallel TCP input and is looking for testers. So he writes, hi, to run TCP input in parallel efficiently, we have to lock the socket in a smart way. I've measured multiple variants, and he provides a measuring page where you can see all kinds of benchmarks and performance metrics. And he continues, the relevant TCP graph is also provided. So he has TCP and TCP6 graph, so you can dig into those numbers, which are definitely looking promising in terms of performance. And what he continues with is the first column left is no locking at all, just exclusive net lock. And the third column is socket lock in addition to exclusive net lock. You see 6% degradation due to locking overhead. This has already been committed. The fourth column on the right is simple switch from exclusive net lock to shared net lock and relying on socket lock. Wrapping the socket lock for each packet is expensive, especially TCP input and SO receive are fighting for the lock. Single stream performance goes down by 25%, but multi-stream goes up by 140%. The second column contains the div below. The idea is that TCP input moves all TCP packets from softnet input queue into TCP input queue. This queue has storage per softnet thread and can be accessed without lock. After running all protocol input functions, but in the same shared netlock context, process the TCP input queue. TCP input M list keeps a pointer to the current socket, and TCP input SO locked tries to keep the lock on the socket. If consecutive TCP packets belong to the same socket, the lock is not released. Only when the TCP stream changes, we unlock the old and lock a new socket. This batch processing of locked sockets gives 5% increase in single stream and 160 for multi-stream throughput. And he has several positive test results and asks if that is okay with the rest. And the rest of the message contains the actual diff and can be applied to a recent OpenBSD kernel or current checkout. It's nice to see that these things properly measured and graphed, right? If you're in a position to test, feedback is welcome as always. Cool. These look very promising.
Yeah, so that was from the 18th of the 4th, 2025. So that will be in current. That won't be in the 7.7 release. So a lot of this is usually worked in stacks that are in the next article that we go into as well. They work in stacks that the developer has, and it's usually kept away from any releases. So this will be pushed early in the development stage into current. So then that way everybody can dog food it for the next 6 months until the next release is done. So, you know, these things are well tested for 6 months prior to them hitting everybody's releases on their computers. So it's a good way of developing. As we've touched on previously in the earlier article tonight about the 7.7 release, this is also going to improve performance by some pretty big numbers here with inside the operating system. So good to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The next is another OpenBSD Journal article. This is back on the 24th, so only a couple of days ago. Introducing an OpenBSD LLDP daemon. So LLDP is the link layer discovery protocol, and it's used typically with inside networking environment to identify devices. So you can do conditional things on a port, set it into a certain VLAN, or, you know, some ports might share two VLANs. One will be a PVID, which is usually our access device, and the other one will be a tagged, which is like typically a desk telephone or something like that, mm-hmm. of that nature. So LLDP is used extensively in the networking space. This brings an LLDP daemon to the OpenBSD operating system. So then it can listen to LLDP packets that go over the wire. So the article goes, our favorite operating system may be on the verge of having a LLDP, or Link Layer Discovery Protocol daemon, added to the base system. David Gwynn is circulating a patch on the tech list that introduces the daemon. And David's email goes, this adds a small daemon and command line tool for receiving and displaying LLDP messages from neighbors connected to Ethernet interfaces. The daemon is called OLLDPD. To avoid colliding with the existing LLDP from ports. The command line tool is LLDP. It uses the AF frame sockets that were recently added rather than BPF. This means it retains fewer privileges while it's running because it doesn't have to open the configure and configure BPF devices when new interfaces appear on the system. Avoiding BPF, it means it has basically zero impact on the kernel packets path because the AF underscore frame is handled as a last resort for the packets rather than upfront for every packet on the interface. It's good enough for now that I can leave the daemon running and it handles the interfaces coming and going and LLDP neighbors coming and going. The command line utility defaults to a brief output but can produce verbose output that handles most of the basic set of LLDP information from the specification. Now that I've done the easy bits, the AF frame and the packet reception, I think it's time to get it into the tree so people can help with the hard stuff, pretty printing of C strings. Things that I'd like to get working in the future are pass organizationally specific TLVs from IEEE specs, allow configuration to disable LLDP reception on specified interfaces, and query the daemon for stats and counters. Things that I do not want to get working in the future. support for any other protocols like CDP, EDP, etc. Yes, they're all proprietary protocols, and why they should all have to adopt a standard IEEE spec. Anyway, long term, it should be reasonable to implement TX so OpenBSD can send LLDP packets to neighbor devices. This is what the command line tool looks like. And there's a dump there of running the LLDP. And you can see the different interfaces that are being received on the system. Discussions are ongoing and the code is in early form as indicated. But if you're in a position to test and comment, you're invited.
Yep. Ah, just another nice new tool to check out, right? Next, we are switching a little bit away from OpenBSD. This is about Hardware Discovery, ACPI and Device Tree by Giulio Marino. And he always has very intensive or into detail going blog posts. This is no different. So we're not covering it a whole, but just as a brief overview so that you can dig deeper if you're interested in this kind of part of an operating system. So it starts out with if you grew up in the PC scene during the 1980s or early 1990s, you know how painful it was to get hardware to work. If you did not witness that, lucky you, here is how it went. Every piece of hardware in your PC, say a sound card or a network card, had physical switches or jumpers in it. These switches configured the card's I/O address space, interrupts, and DMA parts, or ports, and you had to be careful to select values that did not overlap with other cards. But that wasn't all. Once you had configured the physical switches, you had to tell the operating system and or software which specific cards you had and how you had configured them. Though this is what really for the people who have been around that long. Remember, set blaster equals A220, I5, D1, H5. No, this is no Star Wars term. This DOS environment variable told programs which specific sound blaster you had installed and which I/O setting you had selected via its jumpers. For example, in computer games, if you wanted sound and via a specific sound card, then you had to use, 220, I5, and D1. So these are the things that you had to set back in the day. That was a nice little trip memory lane for me. So how does the kernel know which physical devices exist and how does it know which of the many devices or device drivers it contains can handle each device? Enter the world of hardware discovery. When you learn about the von Neumann architecture in school, you're typically told that there is a CPU, a chunk of memory, and I/O devices. The CPU and memory portions are where all the focus is put, and the I/O devices portion is always left to the reader. However, there is a lot of stuff happening in that nebulous cloud. The first question that arises is, what's in that I/O cloud? Well, take a look. So this is a screenshot from a Windows 2000 device manager for those who've been around. And there's plenty of stuff in there like PCI buses, media control devices, microcode update devices even. And some of these split into sub-devices and sub-sub-devices. That's a lot of stuff, but we can classify the items in that nebulous cloud of I/O devices into two categories: the devices themselves, obviously, and the buses that connect these devices to the CPU. Both are important. You might have a fancy keyboard with extra keys that requires a special driver, and this keyboard might come in PS2 and USB versions back in the day. The driver for the keyboard may be the same for each version, but the glue that attaches this keyboard to either bus is different, and the way the kernel can tell whether the keyboard is attached to one port or another also differs. So a little further down, he provides a little snippet of a default NetBSD kernel config file for the AMD64 platform. And this snippet lays out the topology of serial ports in the PC and the buses in which they may appear. So you say things like ISA0 at main bus ? Or COM0 at ISA ? Port 0x3f8 IRQ4 and some others. So daunting if you have never seen anything like this, I know. But let me translate this to a diagram. So he provides a diagram with hierarchical, where at the top there's main bus, and from there it splits off ISA0, PCI, and ACPI separately. And those split into further, like in PCI, you have PCI bus, the PUC, and the COM. And that could also result in an ISA separate bus with COM0 and COM1 as sub-devices. Hardware auto configuration. To answer the question of how the kernel discovers which hardware is present and where it is, let's dissect NetBSD's AutoConf manual page. It says, auto-configuration is the process of matching hardware devices with an appropriate device driver. In its most basic form, auto-configuration consists of the recursive process of finding and attaching all devices on a bus, including other buses. And he goes into more detail about how the BSDs do these and the equivalence of the set blaster statement that we had in the DOS area. And then it goes into a section about ACPI, which is, despite being declared with ACPI 0 at main bus 0 in a form similar to ISA 0 at main bus, is not a bus. ACPI does not physically connect devices to one another. To understand what ACPI does, we can start by realizing that it stands for Advanced Configuration and Power Interface. And he continues about explaining what this does and how it's a little bit better than the old ways of doing things, which then leads into device trees and how like embedded devices use these more, DTBs, and a little bit more. So it really is a detailed article about the evolution of device drivers and handling those. So check that whole article out if you're interested in more details. I seem to have lost Jason, and I didn't notice until now. Whoops. Let me just continue. He will be back. So there is the 2025 FreeBSD Community Survey. Hopefully it's still up by the time this episode airs and becomes available for everyone. So the FreeBSD Foundation has put up an accompanying blog post that says, the FreeBSD core team and the FreeBSD Foundation invite you to complete the 2025 FreeBSD Community Survey. The purpose of the survey is to collect quantitative data from the public to help guide the project's priorities and the efforts, of course. Your input is very important to us. The survey will remain open until May 7, 2025, so we ask for your prompt participation. Yeah, it could be critical by the time this comes out, but we'll see how it goes. It should take approximately 15 minutes to complete. Thank you for your help. So this is all about how you use FreeBSD, what areas you think are good, what areas you think would need improvements, and so on. So this is good for gauging further activity and making sure we develop FreeBSD in those areas that are already quite good, get better, also in that areas that are needing a little bit more attention. And that is your way of, you know, providing feedback to the people behind the code, basically. All right. I just heard that Jason's PC locked up in some way or the other, but he'll be back up, just rebooting laptops, and then he will rejoin me. So we could probably look a little bit ahead into or make a little bit of a small commercial break in of a sense, because we also have feedback and questions this way. And if you want to send us questions, have a comment about the show, some ideas or topics you want to cover, or a story of your own in the BSD space, send this to feedback@bsdnow.tv. This is the email address there where you can reach us. And you can also join us in our BSD Now Telegram channel on t.me/BSDNow. You fill out a little captcha, and then you're part of sometimes very quiet, sometimes very active group of BSD Now listeners, and you can discuss the show and all kinds of BSD thingies in there, or just listen in what people have talked about or what are they currently discussing. And if you want to support this show, let us congratulate about this decision. So this is on Patreon. This is patreon.com/BSDNow, where you can find different sponsor levels. And we also always include a little bit of a pre-show before we do the live recording that you are hearing now, and where we discuss a little bit of our own private projects, things we've been doing, or things that we have been involved with, or future things we plan to do, like conferences. So this is only for the Patreon people as a kind of a little thank you, extra stuff for people giving us money that is then going into the show production and making sure that the show is still sustainable. All right. What else is there? We have feedback and questions. I would hope that Jason is back by now, but seems like he's not, so I'm just filling time. We'll probably cut out this whole wait for Jason part, and then you cut it nicely together, so JT will do the magic there and you won't hear what I've been saying up till this point. So that's a gap that we have to live with. That's fine. Hope it's not serious. Luckily, it didn't drop out while he was reading something, so it could probably stay hidden behind the regular items I was reading. So let's see. Things happen which are unpredictable. I think I never had that where one of us dropped out of a live recording. At least not with, since we're using Riverside. As long as he doesn't have to do extensive repairs on the software side. Hopefully it's not the new OpenBSD release. That would be a bit of a... We've been praising it so much here. But we'll see when we have him back to hear what's happened. Could be the pre-show for next episode. Nicely connects together. Ah, he seems to be back online, at least here in the messenger. Looks promising. Ah, so his PC has died. Okay, and then he's getting his laptop up. So apparently the machine is needing some longer repairs, and he's now switching to the laptop to make things work again. He can then diagnose the PC a little later. Huh.
BSD Now is sponsored by Tarsnap. Everyone needs backups, and Tarsnap ensures that your backups are not only safe, but also secure. Your data is encrypted on your device before being sent to the cloud. You can be sure that only you have the ability to read your data. Tarsnap takes your data and works out what is duplicated. It then assembles the data into compressed blocks, encrypts them with your local private key, and this key never leaves your system. The data is then uploaded into the cloud. Even if someone is able to obtain your data in the cloud, they will not be able to decrypt it and access your files. Tarsnap is easy to use. If you can use Tar, then you can use Tarsnap. Tarsnap is prepaid, so you never have to worry about an unexpected bill. Tarsnap is fully open source, allowing you to inspect the code and make sure it does what we say it does. And Tarsnap has bug bounties so that if you find errors in the code, you can get paid for helping make the software better. With clients on all major platforms, there's no excuse not to have good backups. Go to tarsnap.com to learn more.
Why don't I read this feedback here and finish this episode so he has time to come in and then join me in the next one. So we have feedback and questions this week, and the feedback comes from Brad, and he has some new users. And this is what he wrote. Hello, BSD Now crew. As a dedicated BSD user for several years now, I use FreeBSD for servers wherever possible. Cool. And I've tried to use several of the BSDs for desktop needs sometimes. I wanted to surface a video from Explaining Computers where he tries GhostBSD, MidnightBSD, Hello System, and NomadBSD as desktop alternatives. He's a heavy Linux desktop user, primarily focused on the small form factor mini computers with x86 and ARM and RISC-V. I would say he's at least a good middle of the road, the above average in the Linux user world. Okay. All of the issues he highlights in the video are ones I have also experienced when trying out the pre-rolled desktop systems. All right. I'm not sending in this video to bash any of the involved OSs, but to highlight maybe a few places we could all polish to help with user adoption in the BSD world as they want to make the jump. The October 2025 Windows end of life, regardless of life and performance left in the excluded systems, I feel will drive a lot more of the non-Microsoft alternatives to be picked up because a lot of people just can't afford to buy new hardware. Yeah, that is true. And people are naturally then looking, hey, the hardware is still valid and good for a couple more years, and I can't use Windows anymore. What other alternatives are there without having to buy new hardware? And the BSDs and a Unix in general is a good choice for that. And I was at a conference or at a BSD table last weekend in Graz, Austria, where we also had a free BSD table there, and a lot of people talked to us and were interested in BSDs, what they can do, what's the difference between Linuxes and the licenses and all that. So we had a good amount of exchanges between what people have told us or what they were interested in, and so we could gauge a little bit of what people are needing and what kind of concerns they might maybe have, or you know, what their needs are. And this is nicely tying into this feedback. So definitely these are good things to have, and individually GhostBSD, MidnightBSD are desktop friendly, and Hello System as well as NomadBSD. So if you want to run a desktop on BSD, it's definitely possible, and it's a nice experience because most of the applications are the ones that you are used to. You get the same KDE experience, you get the same GNOME experience, or any other desktop environment. You have the choice between X11 and Wayland, and then you basically install the applications that you need and are used to. And the rest is just underlying operating systems. Most commands are the same. That's my argument always. You copy, move, CP, LS are all there and do what they are supposed to do. And it's only a couple of extra utilities and commands that are new on the BSDs. But the delta there that you have to learn is quite different. It's a bit more difficult if you're coming from Windows, but if you're switching from a Unix to a BSD or from a, let's say, Linux to a BSD, that difference in commands you have to learn or relearn is negligible. So for Windows users, maybe a bit of a learning curve, but if you're serious about switching and don't want to run the next Windows with hardware that is a bit more, you know, resource heavy, or you don't want Windows recall, even though they promise they can, you can disable this feature, remains to be seen. Look at the alternatives. That's what I had done when I had the choice of, do I switch to Windows Vista back in the day, or do I switch to a Mac or to a Unix? And the learning curve was equally for all of these systems. So I switched with, chose the non-Windows route, and I've been a happy user ever since. And I can't use Windows these days. It's nothing I'm familiar with. And if you have individual questions about something that's not working or is a different experience that you thought it should be, then let us know also on feedback@bsdnow.tv, and we'll be happy to discuss this in a future feedback section in the show. So thanks for this feedback, Brad. And this brings us to the end of this episode. Jason is not yet back, but, well, these things happen. I'm still here, so I can properly finish, say goodbye, and thank you for listening as always. We will have another episode available for you next week, and by then, Jason will definitely be back.